I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And before we get to this morning's scheduled conversations, we're going to take a moment to discuss what's probably on a lot of our listeners' minds, the resignation of Missouri Governor Eric Greitens, who's been at the center of a whirlwind of scandals for more than a month now. Nobody knows that better than KCUR's Brian Ellison. He's been following the story closely, and he's got the very latest for us right now. Good morning, Brian.
Morning, Gina.
We're not usually in this room at the same time.
I know.
So
it's
weird.
It's weird to see each other in these chairs.
So let's start with a quick synopsis of what happened yesterday and what led to it for people who are still catching up with the day's news.
Missouri Governor Eric Greitens, as you said, resigned yesterday. It was a surprise announcement. He called the press conference. Word went out maybe at 3:30, 3:45, and the press conference was at 4:30. He announced that as of Friday, June 1st, he will no longer be governor at 5 p.m. This comes, of course, after a whole cascade of allegations and investigations, possible criminal charges still pending with an invasion of privacy case that is now in the hands of a special prosecutor, which is Jackson County's Gene Peters Baker. There's talk about computer data tampering, although there might be a resolution coming to that case later this morning. There are investigations of campaign funds from his gubernatorial campaign and a nonprofit so-called dark money group that may have been interacting with that campaign. There's a lot still going
No shortage of pieces to this puzzle.
But for now, he has said he's out as of Friday at 5 p.m.
This is a move we might have expected a long time ago, given all the allegations and really damning stories coming out about him. But he didn't step down for so long. What changed?
Well, that's a great question, and it's hard to get inside the mind of Eric Greitens, but you're absolutely right. He said over and over that he would not resign, that he was under attack, and that he needed to fight for the people of Missouri. What many people are pointing to is a decision yesterday morning in a Cole County courtroom where the judge ruled that a subpoena that's from the House Investigating Committee, they asked for documents from both his campaign and that nonprofit group, A New Missouri Incorporated. The governor's lawyers had challenged that subpoena, said that they didn't have a right to those documents, that it was a fishing expedition. But the judge upheld the subpoena, said it was enforceable, and that those documents, which might potentially reveal some donors whose identities had previously been kept secret, when it said that that was enforceable and the governor's team would have to turn those over. Don't know if that's the reason for the resignation, but a lot of people are saying maybe that was the final straw.
Were you surprised by yesterday's resignation? It's like the surprising, not surprising news.
I think that's very well put. I was surprised. I've been saying on the record in a lot of places that I didn't think the governor would resign. It doesn't seem to be part of his personality, and that certainly would be taking him at his word as well. Having said that, though, when you think about the cumulative effect of all of this, just on a person, on the reality that he'd been subpoenaed to testify himself and was probably going to have to appear before the House committee next week. When you think about the effect on your family and on your coworkers and on the staff, on your ability to have influence in the state, it's possible that it just finally got to him and said, this is enough.
We should note that this resignation did not include an admission of any kind. He's still denying that any of the stories coming out about him are true.
That's exactly right. And that is an important point. He has not acknowledged, he's acknowledged having the affair back in 2015, but has not acknowledged taking that incriminating picture or threatening to use it for blackmail. The governor, in fact, in his resignation speech, it's a speech that's going to go down in the annals of resignation speeches as being among the more combative. He said, all of this was designed to inflict maximum damage on my family. It didn't include apologies for his conduct. It included a pledge to keep fighting and a reminder that that he was the target of something, that he was the victim.
So what happens now?
Well, now at 5 o'clock on Friday, Lieutenant Governor Mike Parson will take the oath of office and assume all of the powers and duties of the governor. What happens now specifically is a good question, because we're at kind of an interesting moment in the legislative year. All of the laws that were approved, the bills that were approved by the House and the Senate, are now on their way to the governor's desk. They should be there before the governor has to resign on Friday. So it's a question of whether he will actually sign those bills into law or veto them potentially, or just leave them on the desk for the next governor. But we still need to see that the budget is approved. There's vacancies on state boards, including the Board of Education. So Mike Parson is not going to get a slow start to his job.
No. What do you think will be the legacy of this governorship? Will it be the scandal and resignation or something else?
Well, you know, obviously we're really close to it at the moment, so that's a hard question to answer. But I think it's very difficult to see how the tumult and the turbulence of this governorship won't be its defining characteristic. Maybe not just the scandal and resignation, but even going back to last year, the bullying of lawmakers during the session, the combative way he approached his job, even his campaign, which was to root out the so-called corrupt career politicians of Jefferson City. I think Eric Greitens will be a figure who is very long remembered in Missouri politics, but probably not favorably.
Well, Brian, you're hosting Up to Date at 11 this morning, where you're going to be digging into all of this a little bit deeper. Who will you be talking to?
We're going to talk to some journalists who've been covering this story from the beginning. Joe Manis, a colleague over at St. Louis Public Radio, as well as Brian Houseworth from Missouri Net. We'll also talk to some legislators and political leaders from the Kansas City area. Both parties to get their take, and a political science professor, too. We also want to hear from our listeners what their take is on this and what questions it raises for them. So that's all coming up at 11 o'clock.
Brian, thanks so much.
Thank you, Gina.
Stick around for Up to Date, hosted by Brian Ellison, for more on the resignation of Missouri Governor Eric Greitens. This is KCUR's Central Standard. This is a news report from Russia One. That's a government-owned television station. The woman they're interviewing says she witnessed Ukrainian troops crucifying a 3-year-old boy. The report sparked outrage in the Russian and Ukrainian independent media, not because of the brutality of the story, but because it turned out to be completely fake. We talk a lot about Russian-generated fake news here in the U.S., how it affects us and makes us vulnerable to manipulation. It's easy to forget that this is a problem that affects the citizens of Russia, too. So in a weird way, the struggle against fake news is something we share across an otherwise gigantic divide. That connection is the basis of a big project at KU. Journalism professors there have been working with colleagues at a Russian university to develop a curriculum for recognizing and not perpetuating fake news. I'm Gina Kaufman. Let's talk to some of the professors behind that. Lisa McClendon, hello.
Good morning.
This is all so timely. Just today, we have this whole kerfuffle over a Russian journalist who's been fiercely critical of Putin, reported dead, supposedly murdered for standing up to the Kremlin, but he just showed up at a news conference in Ukraine?
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? And I think it ties into some of the fake news things that we've been seeing, because it starts out with something that is believable. It may not be true, but it's believable. And because other Russian journalists have been killed, no one seemed to think that that was, you know, something that was way out there. I'm glad he's okay. I'm really glad that it's not another one that this happened to. But that's one of the things that we talked about in our project is, you know, things often have a kernel of truth or a veneer of credibility.
Or come with a larger story that's true when the detail is not.
Right.
That's crazy. Well, tell me, first of all, about this project, what you're doing exactly, how the whole thing worked.
Well, we applied for a grant from the State Department last summer, and we got it. And what we're doing is we're developing training materials for journalism students. And also career, you know, professional journalists. But the focus of the program is for preparing journalism students to be a little bit more skeptical, to give them the tools to check out things that they see on social media, to check photos, to check videos, to find out who's behind a Twitter account or a website, things like that, so that they're not having to take things at face value that they maybe see popping up online going viral.
And this is for journalists here and there, and
yes,
presumably just
yes,
internationally.
Yes, yes. It's the website that we're building of training materials is bilingual. So it's for anyone who speaks English or Russian. And a lot of the materials that we're using, you know, I've used in my journalism classes. They have used in our partner university, the University for Humanities in Yekaterinburg. They're using it with their students as well.
The last time we talked, you were at the very earliest stages of this collaboration, months into it. Can you give us a sense of what you've learned from your peers in Russia that you didn't go into it expecting or knowing already?
Oh, we've learned a ton of things from them. When we visited, Vitaly and I and another journalism
professor. And we'll meet Vitaly in just a moment.
When we visited in February, we also visited some media outlets. So we worked with our university partners, but we also met some media professionals. And it was very, very interesting to see how the changes in journalism, some of them have manifested in the same way that they have here, and others have, you know, turned out a little differently. So that was really interesting. It was very interesting to meet the students who were going through the program to see how they were doing. They tended to be much more skeptical, I think, than our students did sort of right out of the gate. Our students tended to be, at least in my observation, and this is not a huge sample size here, our students tended to be more trusting and tended to take things more at face value until they were trained to do otherwise.
That's a little scary. I mean, I understand what would be the cause of that, but no matter where you live, it is just definitely the whole mentality of journalism to be skeptical.
Yes, yes. But again, these are students,
yeah,
and so they, you know,
off.
They're learning, and this is what we're, I mean, we're here to teach them that, and that's a good thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, I just, like I said, I think that ours are coming in with a much lower level of skepticism.
So we're going to hear more about this from your colleague who will also be joining us, but what inspired you to take this on? Can you take us to that moment in your thought process?
Well, you know, we've been... The journalism department here at KU has worked closely with the Center for Russian and East European Studies, where Vitaly works. And, you know, we've been trying to find things that we can work together on. And, you know, verification and fact checking is an incredibly timely topic. I've been developing a lot of materials for my own students already. And other colleagues are working on sort of media literacy in general. And so this seemed like a way that we could put some of this into practice and learn from international partners, as well as share some of our own material internationally.
Well, we're joined by Vitaly Chernetsky of KU's Center for Russian, East European, and Eurasian Studies, who can talk a little bit more about this. Hi, Vitaly.
Good morning.
As someone from Ukraine who's lived in Russia, what did you think was particularly compelling about this idea of working with a journalism program over there on the problem of fake news, sort of partnering across journalism programs?
Well, this gave us an opportunity to look into the changes that have happened, the enormous changes where political change in our two societies coincided with the development of internet, online media, and so on and so forth, and how it impacts our media literacy, how it impacts both ordinary citizens, how they consume news, but also how it impacts professionals in the journalism field.
Can you talk about that a little bit more? Just, I mean, I feel like you're kind of alluding to this sense of people not knowing what is real and what is not when they're consuming information in a much sort of broader way.
Yes. The thing is, what happened is historically in Russia, from the establishment of the first newspaper in the early 18th century up until very recently, all news media were under very strict government control, whether it was censorship and things that go beyond censorship. So there was very little, almost no history of genuine freedom of speech. There was a brief period between 1905 and 1914, a few months of 1917, and that's basically it. So the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991 created tremendous opportunities, but also put a lot of people at a loss. And also there wasn't a long-standing tradition of ethical guidelines and understanding how this profession works. And this created a very murky situation in Russia. There were a lot of people who eagerly embraced the caricature image of postmodernism, that there is no truth out there, that everything is manufactured. And in the case of Russia, what we see is a strange paradoxical combination of gullibility and absolute cynicism. So the healthy middle ground of being a skeptical, critically thinking individual who does not take everything at face value, but also does not fall into complete cynicism, saying that there is no truth out there, that there is no way of verifying facts. That was the major challenge. And also the more...
In your impression, I mean, you would say that it's not true, that you can't verify facts, like that you can find the truth even in a situation like that.
Well, one has to... first of all, not go with the idea that everything is completely fake and manufactured, that there is a possibility of finding truth, that there are ways of trying to create. And there are a lot of now electronic data that that is also, and a lot of tools that are available for that. And we are quite proud that one of the KU alums, Eric Toller, who works for a nonprofit called Bellingcat, which has been doing a lot of investigating of things like that, and actually giving verifiable information about things like the details of the conflict between Russia and Ukraine in 2014.
Back when you were applying for this grant and waiting to hear about it, this grant to collaborate with a Russian university on fighting fake news, U.S. diplomats were being kicked out of Russia. So when you found out you'd gotten it, were you at all concerned that this collaboration might face just logistical obstacles? Or is academia somehow immune to the political forces that make diplomacy so challenging?
Oh, academia is certainly not immune. And we see these difficulties affecting people on the ground, whether they are applying for Fulbright fellowships or other grants of this kind. And the number of grants that I awarded through the State Department program also was radically slashed. We were told by the State Department officials that in the past they gave about 40 grants a year. Last year they only awarded 7. In part because of these logistical challenges. We also were restricted in that we had to partner with a private Russian university because this is a state-funded grant, and so U.S. taxpayer money could not go to support a Russian state institution. And in difference from this country, in Russia, state universities actually are an endangered species. They only came into being in the early 90s. They tend to be poorer than state universities, and they face a lot of government pressure, and many of them were able to survive with great difficulty, and a lot of them were shut down. So we are very fortunate that the partners we have in Yekaterinburg are a university that is very brave, that is very ethically, professionally consistent, and that especially is really acclaimed for its broadcast journalism program with whom we collaborated.
So Lisa McClendon, how does the problem of fake news in Russia compare with what we talk about when we're talking about fake news here in the United States?
Well, I think that there are a couple of things at play. One of the things here in the United States is that people tend to label fake news any news that they just don't like. And as Vitaly was talking about earlier, we have this long history of, you know, being able to trust Walter Cronkite and people like that on the news. And so people generally in the past had a very high trust in the veracity of journalism, that they saw their daily newspaper, the people on TV and things like that. And so that history is very different in Russia, where they're used to not trusting the news because it is state censored or propaganda even. So we're coming from very different places on the approach to fake news. That in here, I think that, you know, we're still not, you know, we still sort of trust things that we see, even if it's on social media. You know, whereas the history in Russia of not having a free press, of not having, you know, unbiased media, that the media always has the state agenda. That's a very different perspective when you're talking about, you know, fake news. It's not always the same thing. It's like there's propaganda, there's fake news, there's partially true, there's slanted news, things like that. So while we are dealing with the same kinds of challenges in fact checking and verification, what we're working on, you know, we're kind of coming from different backgrounds and approaches to this.
I'm curious about whether the techniques for a Russian journalist are the same as they would be for American journalists, or if the difference in social and political context require really different approaches to getting the truth, telling the truth, and even the consequences or repercussions of noticing and revealing a fake news story.
Yeah, there's going to be a lot of difference there. I mean, the tools are going to be really similar. I mean, to check on whether a photo is fake, we use the same tools. I mean, you can use things like TinEye to see, is the photo what it says it is? Has it been doctored? When was it first released? That's a lot of things that go viral on social media. The photo's real, but it isn't what the caption says it is. There was one that happened that was going around during Hurricane Sandy, as an example, of a serviceman at Arlington National Cemetery, and he was wearing, rain gear, and he was in this driving rain. And the caption said, here's a soldier standing guard at the tomb of the unknown soldier in the middle of a hurricane. Well, the photo was real, but it was taken like 3 years earlier. So the guy was standing out in the rain, but it wasn't during the hurricane. And so those things, there are tools that can help you figure out when it was. There are geolocation tools that we can use to see, is this video where people said it was? Or what can you use from the background to sort of locate something and see, is this where it says it is? Is this when it says it is? Who is the source behind this? And those tools are going to be the same. We're going to use those. I mean, I think any journalist can use those. In terms of presentation of a fact check, that may be a little bit different. You're going to have to judge how you want to present that, first and foremost, by your audience. What's going to convince your audience to trust you that something is fake? And so that's why I think our approaches are probably going to end up differing a lot.
Well, we're going to get back to that, and we'll resume this conversation about fake news versus real news here and in Russia in just a minute. You can call with your questions at 816-235-2888. And we'll bring in a Ukrainian journalist for her perspective. I'm Gina Kaufman with KCUR's Central Standard. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman talking to KU professors Vitaly Chernetsky and Lisa McClendon about a project spearheaded by the School of Journalism there to work with Russian journalism students and professors on identifying fake news and stopping it in its tracks. The collaboration's been underway for a while now, and they're updating us on what they've learned. Hi again, you guys.
Good morning.
So, Lisa, I do want to quickly follow up with you on what you were just saying. You were saying that in our two contexts, the American context and the Russian context, the winning the trust of your audience, whether it's a readership or a viewership, is a very different thing in Russia than it is in the U.S. And I guess the question of trust in the news source, isn't that in some way up to the reader or the listener or the viewer? I mean, isn't that an important piece of how journalism works?
Oh, absolutely. It's a crucial piece of how journalism works. And I think that we're realizing now that you really have to earn that trust, whereas in the past, at least in the U.S., you just sort of were afforded that trust because people trusted the media. And now with all the competing media out there, you have to be transparent about what you're doing. You have to show people the process a little bit more.
And people have been burned.
I mean, yeah. and, so we've had to change the way that we do journalism, because we need to work to earn the trust of our audience.
Well, I want to bring in one of my colleagues now. Anna Yukatenko is a newspaper reporter based in Ukraine. She works for the Kyiv Post, and she's here at KCUR as an Alfred Friendly Fellow. Hi, Anna.
Hi.
So as a journalist in Ukraine, how does the influence of Russia just affect you in your day-to-day work?
Whoa, that's a tough question. Oh, I mean, we are fighting Russian propaganda news especially Kyiv Post. It's like mostly for foreign audience because it's English language newspaper. And we face this huge amount of fake news, and we have to compete basically with them. And it's hard to compete with such a large propaganda machine that Russia have. And I think people often don't realize when it comes to fake news that, like, in Russia, they might be completely fake, just like the scene that I actually did for this show about Crucified Boy, which was, like, a super emotionally, like, I mean, very
emotional. Yeah, like you have a woman crying.
Yeah. So, and it turned out to be completely fake. And this is a good example, I think, of what Russian propaganda media, like what fake news look like in Russia. So they could like hire person to be actor and to actually tell lies. I think it's very different from what fake news are in US.
When you hear the phrase fake news and then you hear the word propaganda, do you think that these are the same thing? Because in the US, fake news is a phrase that feels to me very recent, whereas it seems in some ways synonymous with this longstanding concept of propaganda. But maybe there is a distinction, and I'm curious about your perspective on that.
Well, personally, probably like in my, you know, day-to-day work, I don't really, I mean, I can see the difference in a way, but usually fake news are made to sort of be a propaganda and to...
It's just a form of propaganda.
Yeah, yeah, to persuade people on like what Russian propaganda media want them to persuade to believe in. And they are actually doing like pretty great job. I mean... I was wondering, actually, guys, how you gonna tackle this huge machine? Because just to give an example, part of my family is in Russia and part of it is in Ukraine, and my relatives don't speak to each other about political subjects because those people in Russia, they don't believe my Ukrainian relatives. So how you gonna tackle something as powerful that gonna change your perspective that you would rather believe television than your relatives?
I'm going to let our guests answer that. I'm going to start with Vitaly Chernetsky.
Well, this is a very serious problem, and I think this is a problem that in part is a generational problem. I can say that in Ukraine also, especially in the eastern and southern regions, which historically were more Russified, I see that the older people still, many of them trust more just because of the habits of growing up in the Soviet Union, the news that is emanating from Moscow. And it's a very hard and long and painful process to learn. We were fortunate in our experiences with our partners in Yekaterinburg. I was going there with a great sense of worry, I must say, because as somebody originally from Ukraine, this was my first trip to Russia after Russia's invasion of Ukraine in 2014. And I was obviously very critical of the invasion, of the annexation of Crimea and things of that kind. We found... among our partners and the students at the university, people who are very open-minded, but this is a narrow stratum of society. This is not the typical person on the street. And we had very visible reminders that this is a small segment of the society and that they are working very, very hard to at least preserve this small section of you know, free exchange of ideas. And so even in our conversation with our Russian partners, we did not, for example, discuss the Russian-Ukrainian relations much. And we had a very visible reminder in that the hotel where we stayed was directly across the street from the Putin re-election headquarters. So that was a rather uncomfortable presence for me, frankly.
You know, I mean, the question that I think is at the heart of some of this is, what is the role of a journalist, a really bona fide journalist, someone who is working hard to figure out the truth, determined to tell it, in this problem of fake news? Because those are clearly not the people generating fake news. The problem is originating elsewhere. So I'm curious from Anna, as a working journalist, and Lisa McClendon as the sort of journalism lead on this project, what your perspectives on that are. And I'll start with you, Lisa.
Well, I'm thinking, you know, that if I could just go back one question when you were talking about
Sure.
fake news versus propaganda. Craig Silverman, who works a lot with fact-checking and fake news and things like that, has really defined fake news as something separate from propaganda. That propaganda, we already have a word for. I mean, and it's already a pretty well-defined thing, that fake news, he sees as you know, out there to make someone money somehow or get someone publicity somehow or get clicks and things like that. So he does draw a distinction between fake news and propaganda that is kind of an interesting one, because I do think that they kind of bleed into each other sometimes, because people are going to be using things that are fake to advance a political as well as a commercial agenda.
Yeah, I mean, if what fake news is promoting is a politician, then that is...
Right. But a lot of things, interestingly enough, I mean, and Craig has done a lot of research on this, that many of the outfits that were pushing fake news during the 2016 election were pushing fake stories on both ends of the political spectrum because they were getting clicks and they were making money. That they didn't really have a political agenda. They knew, though, that politics would get people wound up and get them mad and make them click. And every time they got clicked, they got money. So that a lot of it isn't as nefarious as it might seem, that it's people figuring out, oh, hey, we can manipulate these people because they'll click on this and then we make money. Not that it's a great thing, but sometimes but that's a little bit different. And he does draw that distinction there. I just wanted to make that clear that it's not always, you know, a government.
Yeah. But back to what we were an agenda. Just tackling. I mean, this question of the role of a committed journalist in this problem that is originating outside of journalism.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, the role of a journalist is to seek out and verify as many facts as possible. Talk to people, look at documents, check the sources of all your information, and then be transparent about where this all came from. You're never going to be able to, you know, talk to every single person involved with something. But if you can talk with a good sample of knowledgeable people about something and back that up with, you know, other kinds of, you know, statistics or documents or things that might be relevant, that's a good thing.
Well, I want to jump in and ask Anna, you know, for you, is fact checking the problem?
Oh, no, I wouldn't say so generally. I mean, sometimes it can be difficult because stories can be so, like, confusing and twisted. But generally, I think, you know, for me, the biggest problem is actually what did you say that, you know, journalists are not the ones who are making fake news. Well, I would say in Russia, it's like generally the journalists who are making fake news. And I mean, it's another question whether we can call them journalists or not, you know?
Can you explain that?
So, I mean, like, just this example of the feature that I was showing you, it's actually like Russian state-owned media did that. And yeah, sometimes like journalists who are working in Russian outlets are going to be the one who will be like making news or twisting news somehow, making it like, you know, kind of fake, because the initial news would be like so much different. So I think fact checking is very important. And actually in Ukraine, we have like several projects for fact checking. And one of the most, famous one, it's Stop Fake, which basically tackles Russian propaganda and which sort of pick up the most like hilarious stories from Russian outlets and debunks them. So, yeah.
Well, chime in here, Vitaly.
Yes, I just wanted to say that I wanted to second what Anna is saying, is that there is a gray area in the case of Russia, because especially if you work for government-owned media in Russia, there is a lot of pressure, so to speak, to sell your soul and work with the system and abandon whatever ethical standards you might have. And
exactly.
This is a really challenge. And stopfake.org is indeed a wonderful resource, and it brings it a lot of volunteers, often as a guest hosts on those programs, and they have been really wonderful in debunking those.
Lisa, I want to jump in and ask you, as someone whose experience has been primarily in the United States, do you have conversations about this when you talk to your colleagues who teach journalism at a Russian university, and how to address the larger problem, the problem that is larger than merely a fact-checking problem?
Well, it's a big issue. And yes, of course, we've had discussions about it, but it's not like, you know, we can wave a wand and fix the problem. It is complicated. It's big. It's far beyond journalism. I think Anna made a good point saying that, you know, are these really even journalists when they're cranking out fake stories like this? I don't think we can call them that, but they are called that and recognized as such, you know, in certain segments. So yeah, it's a big problem, and we're trying to chip away at a little bit of it at with this project.
Lisa McClendon, Vitaly Chernetsky, with us from KU. Thank you both so much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
And Anna Yukitenko, KCUR's Alfred Friendly Fellow, a reporter for the Kyiv Post, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay with us. What are those bird-like instruments? If you can't find a lot of familiar instruments in this recognizable tune, that is understandable. The recording shows off a slew of handmade, recycled instruments by Amado Espinosa. Amado is making lots of appearances here in town in the next few weeks, including a series of what he's calling junkyard orchestra shows at different branches of the Mid-Continent Public Library. So we've invited him here to tell us about the instruments he'll be playing. Amado Espinosa, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Gina, for inviting me. I am so happy to be here.
Yay, we're happy you're here too. So what were the bird-like instruments we just heard?
Okay, I use a syringe, just as the regular syringe, but the original...
A syringe?
Yes, but the original instrument, the name is koyok. It's from the Amazon, and it's made by bamboo and imitates birds.
So you have used a syringe where typically people have used bamboo.
Yes. So I just, in the syringe, I make a small hole in one side of the syringe, and then I blow just, I can give you a demonstration. I have one in my hand.
Totally amazing. What you are doing, like blowing into this hole that you've made in the part of the syringe that would sort of hold whatever sort of liquid would be in there typically, but in this case, air, and you've got the little stopper deal pulled out, and then you're pushing it in and out while you blow to change the tone.
Yes, it's
Man.
Exactly like me.
How did you get started making instruments in this way? And then we'll talk about the instruments that are sitting in front of me right now.
Okay, why? Because in my country, it's so difficult to...
In Bolivia.
No. Yeah, I am from Bolivia. So it's so difficult to buy like these kind of instruments, saxophone, guitars or flutes. And I started to make these kind of instruments to teach the special poor people they can make their own instrument. So, and in my case, when I started to make this kind of instrument, I was like 18 years old. So I was a teenager and I want to play like a didgeridoo, but in my country, I cannot find this instrument. So I make my own didgeridoo and I use a PVC pipe in the very beginning. So now I have like my didgeridoo, but I'm using a vacuum cleaner.
I see an instrument in front of me that has what looks like a dishwashing glove. I'm not sure what it's attached to. Can you explain what that instrument is?
Yes, it is a bagpipe. So I use a glove for washing the dishes. And then
it's yellow.
A cream container, PVC pipes. And then some plastic bags here. And this one is a popsicle sticks.
Popsicle sticks?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. That is what those are. And then it looks like it's kind of tied together with just string.
Yeah. And it's a fishing string.
Uh-huh.
So, and
fishing line, I guess, is
fishing
what
line.
Yeah.
And when I blow, it has two different sounds.
Whoa, the hand.
So this is the sound of the bagpipe.
I love how you hear it deflating too, but with the visual on this is much more striking than what you see when you see a bagpipe, because you see this the limp hand of the dishwashing glove suddenly blow up like a balloon right before the sound comes on.
Yeah,
and then you see it shrink and fall down again.
Uh-huh. It's very funny. The kids, they like it.
Kids like it?
Yes.
But the process of envisioning an instrument and then figuring out what you have in your surroundings that can perform all the same functions of the parts of that instrument. How has that trained your eye to just see your surroundings differently?
For me, I have a lot of experience making instruments. So when I see some materials, for example, the markers. So
magic markers. You have something made out of magic markers here.
Yeah. So, and I think, oh, why can I make with using that material? So I said, oh, maybe a pan flute. So
wait, how do you make a pan flute out of magic markers?
So I just cut the some parts and the ending of the markers, and then I put together. And I put some tape and rubber band.
So it looks like sort of, so with a pan flute, you've got the cylinders, like the pipes, I guess, that would go from top longest to shortest in sort of a stair step kind of way. And so you've put together markers to make the different lengths.
Yeah, different sizes. So because the sound, I need... like in different notes.
Mm-hmm.
So and sounds very, very good.
You take out the middle, the part that makes the color, basically.
Oh, yeah, yes. I take out, because it needs to be like open, like a tube.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And again, popsicle sticks.
Yes, again, to put together, no?
That is so cool. That is way cooler than anything I've ever done with magic markers.
So I can play any songs with all these instruments.
There's something that looks like a broom.
Yes. This broom is... the name of this instrument is ney. It's an Arabic flute. So I just use a small broom and I make some holes,
It's a metal broom.
Yes, it is a metal.
A pretty slate blue color. But so it's a broom that has a metal handle that was hollow.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And so is this another example of you were like looking at a broom thinking, I can do something with that?
Yeah, because we didn't use this small broom anymore. So
it was just lying around your house?
So instead throwing away, I decided to make a flute. So I said, oh, this, it's very similar. Maybe I can play like a ney technique. Because the ney technique, I need to put in diagonal the flute to make the sound. It's not easy to do it. But sounds very, very, very good.
There's a breathiness to it that I wonder if that's deliberate. Like the breathiness.
Yes, yes. It's special for these kind of flutes. I need to play with this like technique.
That's cool. So tell this other instrument that I'm seeing that looks like a cello.
Oh, yes. There is a
But it's a big metal canister.
Yeah. It is a it's the new one. So I made this recycled cello. I use a trash can and a fork.
Maybe. Wait, where's the fork?
It's holding the strings.
So like that thing at the base of any stringed instrument that is, I think, in a lot of cases, wood.
Yes.
That holds, sort of fans out and holds the strings. Yeah. And where on a violin, there might also be a chin rest kind of attached to that, but on a cello, obviously not. But this is a fork where you've splayed out the tongs.
Uh-huh. And it has a cork.
A cork sort of keeping the strings from just falling flat on the trash can, where you've cut those beautiful shapes that are often on string instruments.
Yeah, and sounds very good, but I am not a cello player, so my wife, she plays very good cello. But you can see the sound. You can hear... It sounds very good, very good.
Well, how would you describe the difference in the sound of your metal trash can and fork cello and a wood cello?
Oh, yeah, the materials. When I use like a wood, so the sound is much louder and warm. But when I use like a metal, it's not. It's like a soft, not too loud, the quality, the materials is very important. But if you don't have a lot of money, you can make your own cello using recycled materials. So that's the idea. So they can practice, and then maybe in the future they can buy a normal cello.
So no? do you teach people how to do this?
Yes. Yeah. So we have a lot of programs for schools. So all the kids, they learn to make their own instruments. So they are making kazoos using a PVC pipe.
Kazoos. That's cool.
Plastic bottle. And they are making the straw flutes. So using just a hole puncher and scissors. And yeah, I think I have one here. I don't know where I put it.
That's okay. You know what? You've got something else in your hand that I want to give you a chance to play a little bit of before we run out of time.
Okay.
So play it first and then tell us about it.
Okay.
What instrument have we just heard, Amado Espinosa?
Okay, this is the charango from South America, from Bolivia and Peru. This instrument original has 10 strings and is one piece of wood. But in my version, my recycled version, I use a cookie can.
Yeah, a cookie tin.
Oh, yes. And...
It's wood. Closed, but with a hole cut in the top.
Yes, and I use a part of the old charango for the neck, and then some 6 wood spoons.
Just that top part that you would actually like dip into whatever you're cooking, not the stem, really.
Yes, and it has like metal strings. 6 metal strings.
And the spoons are what the strings are tied around that you use to tune them.
Yes.
The cookie tin itself has this like court jester type character. It's very striking. It's brightly colored pink and blue and yellow.
Yeah, and looks like a banjo, but it's not a banjo. Maybe a charbanjo.
Amado Espinosa, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me.
Amado is performing all over the place this month. Highlights include an appearance at the Making Movies Carnival at Knuckleheads June 9th, and Amado and Karen's Junkyard Orchestra will be at several branches of the Mid-Continent Public Library. You've got to check Amado's website for all the info because there is way too much to rattle off. AmadoEspinosa.com. We'll also link to it with the audio from today's show, which you will find at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. Tomorrow, The billboards of Warnell display a cast of familiar characters for anyone who spends any time driving up and down that street, from the Tarzan lawman to the Medinas, realtors in matching royal shirts. The billboards of Warnell tomorrow at 10. This show is produced by Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Sylvia Maria Gross, with help from intern Trevor Hook and contributions from Anna Yukatenko. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.